accession number 20268, reel 3.
Ted Harewood, reel 3.
Yes, we made camp just outside Saw, and we all decided, right, this is where we're going to be for Christmas, so we'll construct a shanty town out of the debris from Saw, the city. So we used to go out and do these recces and collect as much material as we could, suitable for erecting small dwellings, which consisted of timber, corrugated iron, that sort of material. And we constructed this shanty town, and I managed to negotiate with the Americans to let us have some 40-gallon drums, and they cut them in half for us, which made suitable ovens to cook our Christmas PX issue, which consisted of turkeys and other poultry. So we managed to do that. We constructed our dwellings, and we got our PX issue, and we had quite a reasonable Christmas. In terms of food, anyway, we had presents from the Americans, you know, from various charities, film stars, and celebrities like that. You know, quite nice presents. So that was quite something, really. The British people seem to have forgotten us completely, because we never had anything from the UK whatsoever. Not a thing. Not even a card, which I thought was pretty bad. And that sort of situation even prevails today. It's still known as the Forgotten War. And anyway, that didn't bother us too much, because there was much merriment. And so we got over the Christmas, and so we thought, right, New Year's Eve, we're still here, you know, nothing's happening, nothing's moving. We're just all standing around waiting for something to happen. So New Year's Eve came, and we and a few others managed to get some Korean whiskey, which we found out to be mostly methylated spirits afterwards. And so we all got fairly merry on that, anyway, the New Year's Day arrived, and a lot of the people were very much under the influence of drink, and partially blinded through drinking too much of this methylated spirits, including some of the officers. And lo and behold, the Chinese decided to attack. We weren't in a very good position to retaliate. In fact, the Americans were overrun. They lost a lot of their heavy equipment, tanks, artillery, etc., and just run away from it all. So we managed to get together and fight our way out of that situation. And after that, there was a lot of regrouping took place, and then the push started once again north towards the 38th parallel, because that became the objective, to get to the 38th parallel and make a stand. That seemed to be the orders of the day. So then we, as I said, we started the conflict once again. Some very heavy fighting, obviously, because this was the Chinese army we were fighting, a bit different to the North Koreans. And they had all the equipment, plus the Russian tanks, which were outmaneuvering the American tanks. So it was a pretty bloody affair. Probably the worst part of the whole Korean War. And we, I remember on one occasion, we'd actually, brigade commander decided to move us out before the rest of the corps, which is the only occasion that ever happened. And so there was forced marching, and we had to move about 40 odd miles, I think, which took a couple of days. And we arrived at this position, and because we'd come back again then, obviously we'd been driven back. And then the brigade commander asked for volunteers to go up and help the American 2nd Division, because they'd been virtually ambushed in between these mountains in the valley, and the casualties were very heavy. So I was one of the volunteers that volunteered to drive a vehicle up there, see what we could do, because we didn't know what we were going to come across, you know, we didn't know what to expect. So when we got there, it was just carnage. Unbelievable. And these truckloads were just coming through. This battle had taken place a few miles north from where we were, but as the Americans came through, truckloads of dead and terrible, horrific screams and shouting and moaning, and it was, well, as I say, it was just an horrific scene to see all this carnage. And we done our best, you know, we were helping the wounded and putting them on vehicles, on our vehicles, because we had a convoy of vehicles, obviously. And on one occasion, I remember I heard this screaming coming from, as I thought, a lorry load of dead American soldiers. The driver was badly wounded, and there was this one soldier, which I found near the back of the vehicle with the tail board down. His leg, and I can't remember which leg it was, but it was nearly severed. It was just hanging on, you know. And he was just screaming, and I attempted to remove him from the vehicle, and he just fought me off. So in the end, I had to knock him out to get him off the vehicle. And I don't know what happened to that chap, because he was so bad that the medics attended to him, the American medics. And so with the people that we'd had, the walking wounded and people that were transportable, we took them back behind the lines, you know, where we were based. But that, to me, was probably the most horrific part of the war, because it was really sad to see so many, you know, Americans.
Had they been hit by bullets or by shells?
Everything. I think the Chinese had just caught them. Apparently they had Maxim machine guns up there, and they just mowed them down in their truckloads as they went through the valley, this pass. I think that's what happened. They were just totally ambushed. Now, whether that was the reason why we moved out before the Americans on that occasion, because they got word of this is probably what the Chinese were going to do, because there was no way you could protect yourself. I mean, there was just these mountains. All they had to do was sit up there and just mow them down as they came through, you see, and that's what they done. It wasn't a battle. It was just a massacre. And as a result of that, the 2nd Division was so badly hit that it was virtually taken out of the conflict for that time. And we the next day were asked to go and see if we could make use of any of the equipment that was left, like utensils, firearms, any equipment, you know, which we thought would be useful, we could have.
And could you?
Yes, we used quite a lot of it. Yes, we did. Yeah. But because it's difficult, because you just know who it belonged to, you know, it was just paddy fields full of this equipment. Unbelievable. It really was. Anyway, we got over that, and then the push carried on. And I think this must have been getting on for sort of for perhaps April, beginning of May 1951, and we moved up to Pyongyang, where we that's where all the political manoeuvring took place, where finally the peace treaty was signed in Pyongyang. No, sorry, not Pyongyang, I've got that wrong. It was
Panmunjom.
So we'll have to, that's incorrect, because I've mentioned
that's
that.
That's right, you've corrected.
Twice, yeah. Panmunjom, and we sat there for a while. The conflict was still going on, and we were due to leave Korea in May. And the big spring offensive started round about that time. We had everything packed, ready to leave. And suddenly we had the orders, we're going to unpack everything, because the New Zealanders, the 25-pounders, were trying to hold off this big spring offensive. And we got to go up there and help them. And it was quite something else, because we went up there and finally reached the position of the New Zealanders. Bearing in mind, they should be well behind the lines. There's 25-pounders artillery. And they were firing these 25-pounders off the back of the quads. They were still they were still linked to the quads, yet they should have been unhooked and positioned. But that's the sort of thing that was going on. Anyway, we managed to help the New Zealanders, or the Kiwis, as we used to refer to them as, to get out of that situation. And we came back. And for us, that was the end of the Korean conflict. Sometime in, I think, probably the end of May, can't remember the exact date, we packed up and left for Incheon, the port. So we arrived there, not much left of Incheon, you know, it was virtually flat. And we boarded the American former Second World War Liberty ships, you know, the flat bottom welded ships, loaded everything on there, and left Korea, bound for Hong Kong. The sea was pretty rough. We all the vehicles obviously were lashed in the holds, but because the sea was so bad, they came adrift, and most of our equipment the time we reached Hong Kong was just destroyed, because you know, they'd been sliding around, crashing into each other. The carriers weren't too bad, but most of the vehicles, they were just so badly damaged, they were just scrapped. But the ship was so bad, you know, because people were seasick, and I remember one particular person nearly died through vomiting. And So the captain of the ships ordered that the ships had to lay off Hong Kong harbour, and the ships had to be cleaned up before they went into to harbour, because they were in such a mess. And when we had only 2 or 3 foot of water in the sleeping areas of the ship, it was really bad. But those who weren't seasick, there was plenty of food. You could go out in the mess and it was absolutely empty. So, and I was fortunate, I could, you know, handle the rough seas, so it wasn't too bad. But, so we finally got into harbour in Hong Kong, and I was one of the people that stayed behind and helped offload the vehicles, and say they were just a mess. Most of the stuff was just left on the harbour, and that's what was taken away for scrap. So as a result of that, we were late back to late getting to the barracks. So I didn't have a mosquito net that night, and I got virtually bitten alive with mosquitoes, and so that was pretty. I thought, well, we just left Korea, and then we're getting attacked by the mosquitoes. But I got a touch of a fever as a result of that, I think, a few days afterwards. But anyway, managed to get through that. Because it was extremely warm too, particularly after leaving Korea. You know, temperatures 100 degrees. That was very warm. So really, that was the end of our Korean adventure, if you like to call it that.
You were telling me earlier off the record about your COs having to be persuaded to use a different type of machine gun.
Yes, that's right.
You can repeat that story.
Yes, yeah, that occurred. That was during the sort of beginning of the winter, when everybody had been issued with American uniforms. And there was Colonel Mann still wandering about with, I think he had, I'm not sure whether he had American trousers on, I can't really remember, but he still had his British battle dress and his peaked cap. And he was just wandering around, and in the end we heard that he'd gone down with exposure and been taken back further behind the lines, probably to A echelon, and that the brigadier had ordered him that he must wear the proper Arctic equipment. So the next time we saw him, he had the American uniform on. But, and I think this is correct, he had the pile hat on one day, I remember this, which came, it was the fur hat, with his peak cap on the top.
The pile hat?
A pile, they called them pile hats, because it was a piled fur inside, but they weren't waterproof. You had to have a windbreaker, which was also waterproof, over the top of that. And that was, you had to be very careful not to get that material damp or wet, because that could be lethal. They weren't, I don't think the equipment was as good as the British equipment, because the British had these Canadian Parkers, which they were all in one. So they were a much better garment than the ones we had.
But you also told me how he eventually agreed to using American automatics.
Yes, on this account. Now this was early on in the conflict, before the winter hit us. We were having problems with spare parts for the Vickers machine gun, and I come across this American ordnance, and they said, oh, we've got some spare Browning guns here, would you like one of those? I said, oh yes, great, but we didn't have any spares. So some ammunition, they fired 300s against 303. So we couldn't use the 303 ammunition. So we mounted this on one of the carriers, and we went down to this bank to test this riverbank, to test this gun, and it worked well. And Colonel Mann got to hear about this, and he was livid that we had the audacity to mount an American machine gun on front of one of his carriers. That just wasn't on. So we were ordered to remove it immediately, which we did, of course. But the RSM apparently had a word with him, and he softened slightly by saying that we could only use that gun if we could get the spares for it. So I thought, right, we go to the American Ordnance, and which was nearby. I went in there and gave them the officers lots of salutes, and they agreed to let us have spare parts, barrels, ammunition, and two or three spare parts wallets. And also we knew that the colonel liked tea, so we asked them about, did they have any tea? Yes, said, we've got cans of dried tea, as they call it. You can have that. We don't drink it. We only drink coffee. So we loaded up with this, and we didn't actually personally give the tea to Colonel Mann, but he got it, and he's very pleased with it all. He can have his tea. And also there was another occasion which just comes a much funnier once you start the flow, is that we during the spring offensive, we got cut off from the rest of the brigade, and I think we were probably cut off perhaps two days or more. We had no food, and we were just collecting these crackers, which was part of the American combat rations that used to come in boxes. Because the Americans used to discard these crackers, they didn't like them. Just a wafer biscuit, you know. So we survived on those, and we run very short of water. And we thought, right, this is not too good. How are we going to get out of this one? Because the MiGs were strafing all the way around us, the MiG fighters. And the Americans didn't seem to be doing too much. And we thought, well, you know, who's going to come to our rescue, as it were? Anyway, all of a sudden, we heard all these vehicles coming, and it was the Australians come to get us out. And it was quite amazing, because there was all this strafing going on, and rifle shots and artillery firing, and there was the Australians on the bank, and they were firing over the top of us as we went through. So it was the Australians who came and got us out of that very serious situation.
Was that the whole Middlesex Battalion?
No, I think it was just our company that, for some unknown reason, they got detached from the rest. Now, the Middlesex, I think most of the Middlesex had moved. I'm not sure how we got into that situation, but we did, and because it was a bit concerning at the time. But we managed to get through that with the help of the Australians.
What were relations like with the Australians?
Very good indeed. In fact, we struck up a very strong rapport with the Australians. In fact, I had a little dog called Sandy, which we rescued. This was during the spring offensive. And we rescued this little dog, and he used to ride in the carrier with us. So they took this dog with them, the Australians, and on the occasions when we were in reserve for a day or so, which wasn't very often, We used to have, you know, just little get-togethers and sing song and that sort of thing. In fact, another occasion has just come to mind regarding that with the New Zealanders, whereby we'd moved quite a long distance, I think forward, yeah, we were moving forward then for the 38th parallel, and we'd run out of fuel, the carriers had run out of fuel, so we had to, our officer went back and said, well, I'll get a fuel vehicle to come up with fuel, but it looks as you all have to stay where you are. So we stayed there, this particular spot, for the night. And unfortunate for us, the United Nations, we don't know who it was, but probably the Americans, decided to have a tank battle with the Chinese. And so we were parked on this road, and these shells were falling all around us. And we thought, God, we're going to get blown to pieces. And but we're lucky, nothing hit us. And when we woke in the morning, there were all these unexploded shells all stuck in the paddy fields around us, either side of this road. Unbelievable. So that was a near one for us. And anyway, the fuel vehicle, the Bowser, or tanker, whichever you like to call it, arrived, and we filled up with fuel, and we moved off. And we hadn't travelled far before we saw this vehicle on its side, and all this equipment around it. We thought, that's all, what's that? It looks like a New Zealander standing there, his uniform. It was a New Zealand cook wagon, the 25-pounders. So we stopped, and we went over there and said, oh, can we help? Oh, we said, if you've got a winch, yes, you can, which we had. So we put the winch on the lorry and got it upright and helped them load all the equipment back on and pulled the vehicle off the paddy field back onto the road. And we struck up quite a friendship after that. And the cook sergeant's name, his nickname was Snowy, because he had white hair. And so he must have been a person in his probably late 30s or 40s, I suppose. And every time we got into reserve, we used to have these little parties. And what the New Zealanders used to do, all the food parcels that they had sent to them from their relatives, they used to collect all this for the occasion when they got into reserve. And they used to have these parties, so you had all the cakes and everything else. And we were always invited, and we found a toy, like a toy gramophone, a wind-up thing, and a small record, and it was China Nights, which was quite popular in those days. And we used to play that, wind this toy gramophone up, and play this record. And so we made great friends with the New Zealanders. And after I got demobbed from the army, there used to be this show called, I think it was Sandy McPherson's Request Show or something, on the radio. Well, apparently he sent a message to me personally. And the record that they played was China Nights, which was, you know, quite something. But unfortunately, I didn't hear it because I wasn't there. But when you're young, I mean, what the logical thing was to do was to follow up and get the address and everything else, which I didn't do. So, and I do intend to...